We get things underway the way we do every single Tuesday. Well, not with Dean Martin.
Purple light in the canyons. That's where I long to be with my three good companions. Just my rifle, pony, and me.
We're talking classic westerns with writer Colin Fleming this afternoon, and one of them right there, Rio Bravo and Dean Martin. Colin, how are you, sir?
Whippoorwill. Oh, Mr. Kimball, you've not lived until you've joined me in the shower where I knocked that very number out with gusto.
I'll put that on my list. Before we talk about a couple of classic westerns, the monument is open, and you have taken charge and command of that obelisk once again.
Yes, I am trying to return to Zulu warrior status, but today, as I headed over there for the fifth straight day of climbing, I beat a hasty retreat with the wind that was coming down, and I figured it'd probably be closed anyway, but I am getting back up to monument speed after it finally reopened following 2 months of being closed.
Glad to hear that. Glad that that's going better. We want to talk about these two westerns because of both are celebrating big anniversaries this year. We'll get to Rio Bravo, which came out 60 years ago, but let's go back a little bit further. It's the 80th anniversary this year of what in many ways was the first of the modern westerns, John Ford's Stagecoach.
Stagecoach established a lot of not just the cinematic grammar of the western, but also the grammar of the American cinema. It's not for no reason that Orson Welles screened it some 40 times, as he was not only prepping for Citizen Kane, Welles was also basically teaching himself how to make films from scratch, going from no experience in cinema to being a virtuoso, and he sat down with Stagecoach for that. Now, one thing that we have to address here, this being the age we are in, and we have to get the turkey gun out to fire it at the elephant in the room, is John Wayne is in this film. He's also in Rio Bravo, and John Wayne is in a lot of trouble right now for comments he made in 1971 and that have resurfaced recently, because that's what a lot of people do now, is they look to the past to see what they can find. Now, they're not very good at it, because you could go through any biography and learn that Herman Melville threw his wife down a flight of stairs, but Moby Dick is still going to be taught. You could do it with anyone, and that is not me excusing John Wayne's remarks, but I'm someone who believes in living your life like a thrown knife. You move on. And John Wayne said horrible things. He said things that I think, right, about white supremacy. I remember reading these remarks when I was younger, and they were kind of congruous with a lot of remarks that people made when they were trying to be provocative, if they were drunk, whatever like that. And I would just say to people, who cares what John Wayne thought? It's
right.
Repugnant, yes, but he's an actor. He's not like actors can't be intelligent or anything, but, I mean, who cares? That's not what you turn to John Wayne for. You turn to John Wayne for what he did in other people's films.
And I don't know how that became newsworthy last week, because if anybody paid any attention to cinema, you already knew that John Wayne was a pretty right-wing conservative guy. He never made a secret of that, and the things he said in this 1971 interview would certainly not have put him anywhere near the fringe in America at this time. But I also think it's interesting, too, as we revise history, that people, and I don't know if it's because they bring the politics into it, but people also downplay what Wayne did. Now, was he the most textured actor in the world? No, but he was iconic for a reason. He had a very specific skill set, and not many were better at what he did.
I don't think that's more really a conservative or liberal thing. His comments were what they were, which are untenable and loathsome regardless of one's affiliation. For instance, I'm neither a liberal nor a conservative. I think a lot of times liberals seek to suppress the very works of art that we are discussing here. And I am clearly not conservative in anything that I do or represent or how I compose or what I speak on, any of that. But the comments were morally repugnant. But at the same time, it's like, you should, if you want to hunt people, you need to be better at hunting people, and then you should go after everybody. As for his acting chops, I think Wayne gets a lot of credit for being a kind of icon. And when we say that someone is an icon in Hollywood acting, it's as if they lack an ability to actually act. But Wayne was a better actor than someone like Humphrey Bogart, who was a lot of the times an icon. He was that guy that you knew as this living kind of caricature, and there he was. When Wayne had a great director, but only when he had a great director, he could be a great actor. Now, I guess you could be a little controversial here and say, oh, he played Ethan Edwards in The Searchers, and that was a racist. Yeah, okay, I get it. But he turned around that character, his beliefs within that film. And to go from being someone who is a racist to not a racist in 2 hours screen time, that takes some serious acting chops. So when John Ford made this film from 1939, Stagecoach, he had decided that Wayne had reached a point in his artistic maturation where he could carry a film, even though he was not billed as the lead. In many ways, it's Claire Trevor's picture more so than Wayne's. But we have that very famous shot. It's kind of this sort of legacy-making shot early on in the film when the Ringo kid turns up, that being John Wayne, and the dolly moves very quickly. It must have been pulled on rope, and it just shoots up to Wayne, and you get this image of him with the rifle, and that is basically the proto-rifleman. And it's one of the most powerful establishing shots for a persona in the history of the movie.
And it made Wayne a star, but it also made, in many ways, Monument Valley a star. It was the first time that John Ford used that setting.
Monument Valley is fascinating in the film because a lot of it, too, was also shot in the studio. But he realized that Monument Valley, and this was Ford's first talkie Western, could be a character. Those buttes that are so recognizable to us now. And if you notice in the Ford picture, and this is one of the first ones to do it, when it's a Western, the stagecoach, the means of propulsion, whatever the crafts may be, the horses, the cavalry, in a Ford picture, they move on your screen from right to left, like a simple map. Like we are moving into the left, the Western portion of this country, and it's actually represented as the left on your screen. And you are in the stagecoach a lot. It's a lot about positioning the camera, how the characters are blocked, that very textured composition of what was, interestingly enough, Maupassant, a French story, Ball of Fat, which was about people traveling in a coach, and there's a prostitute among them, and they get held up by soldiers, and they want to be on their way, and one of the guards in this story says, well, you can move on your way once this prostitute goes to bed with me. And all of these people, these hypocrites, pressure her into doing this so they can get back to their easy lives. And when she does, and they're rolling back along the road again, they shun her. And that figure is represented by Claire Trevor in Stagecoach. And the John Wayne character is basically the only person who's really kind to her. Mm. And they have a very interesting dynamic, I think, where it's not a consummated romance, but there's something, an energy bond between the two of them.
I thought of you as well, because we've talked a number of times on the show about your belief, and you've proven it in your writing, that you don't have to have lived something personally to be able to write about it and capture it. And here's John Ford, who may be one of our greatest directors, and certainly one of our greatest directors of Westerns, who grew up in Portland, Maine.
Shakespeare wasn't the king, but I'd say he knew something about what it was to be a king, right? Knew a little something about regicide, and you can go through all of the great artists there have ever been. And that is the difference between a great artist and someone who has no talent and wishes they had talent and is just hooked up by their cronies. They write about whatever their very limited experiences are. They write about having a trust fund and going to Yale and getting an MFA at Iowa. The true artist is a traveler, an inhabitor. The artist can be you more so than you are, and they can hold up a mirror and give you back to yourself more so who you truly are than you even knew yourself to be. And so John Ford did that with the Western, and he would say, he'd introduce himself to people, "I am John Ford. I make Westerns." And we have to realize the Western was not and is not the prestige niche of cinema. When we just had the Oscars, I always wondered, why does anyone on earth care about Oscars or Grammys? Because if you have anything that is any good, it is not going to win an Oscar. An Oscar film is a film that is usually, almost always, there are exceptions, not going to last. If you go through all of those, so John Ford, Howard Hawks, they're not winning Oscars, but Ford, he could inhabit not just these characters, but these locales, the mythos of the West. The mythos of the West is kind of like the id of the individual. It's this part of ourselves that's dark. It's that sort of journey down the river, except here the river is a prairie, and we are learning about ourselves as we venture into untrampled lands.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Move ahead 20 years and another great Western from 60 years ago made by Howard Hawks, and a different approach, and we see it right in that opening shot that doesn't need a bit of dialogue to establish things.
One of my five or six favorite films. If it comes on, and it's a long film, it's almost 3 hours long, which is interesting because it hardly has any plot. It really relies on interaction and hanging out. And so George Lucas saw this film and he said, you know what, I can do a lot of stuff with lasers and lightsabers and big ships, but I'm really going to hook everybody by having my characters hang out with a couple of droids, an old wizard, all that kind of stuff. A lot of that comes from Rio Bravo. In that opening sequence, it's very Hitchcockian. If you've seen Rear Window, the camera pans over. Here's a photo of a guy in a cast. Here's a magazine, so we know that he's a photographer. The camera's eye tells us the story, and that is what sets up this story of friendship. It is about a drunk, and it is about a friend who still believes in the drunk. Everything in this film is about that relationship, and it stems from the drunk and his rehabilitation as a man. And there are points at the beginning of that soundless opening when dialogue could naturally occur, and Hawks leaves it out. And that's really interesting because Hawks was a very verbal director. He loved the interplay of sharp dialogue, the rhythms of dialogue. I wonder sometimes if he listened to jazz, because he has this kind of natural way of blending what someone knows they wish to say with something that an actor might extemporize. And he still opens it, though, with this moment, this sequence of a cuspidor and Dean Martin, and he's friends with John Wayne, and John Wayne nonetheless beats the crap out of him because he's insulted him, and it sets up the dynamic of their friendship.
Also interesting to note, too, that in many ways, this film was a response from Wayne and from Howard Hawks to all the things they didn't like in High Noon.
Love that, yeah. And Wayne, he got the script, and he thought, this sucks. But Hawks said later that he said that about every single thing that I showed him. And the thing that bothered Howard Hawks about High Noon was that the Gary Cooper character requests help with his job. Personally, me, I'm with Howard Hawks. Do your bloody job, man. You shouldn't be asking these people to bail you out. So he really establishes this treatise early on. This is going to be his thesis. And you have that exchange with Ward Bond, who comes into town and he's brought Ricky Nelson with him and all of that stuff. And he knows that they have to hold this man, Claude Akins, by the way, who is in basically everything. He's in your episode there of Twilight.
Yes, Jones, indeed.
Doing Maple Street. But if you've ever seen Bonanza, anything, this guy is just the ultimate character actor. And Ward Bond looks around and he says, this is what you have. You have a drunk. You have you, to John Wayne. And you have Walter Brennan, who is supposed to be crazy in the movie, but he's actually, like, weirdly competent, which is pretty funny. And he says, that's all you have. And John Wayne looks at him and he says, and I just love this. See how subtle this dialogue is, but clever. He says, that's what I have. And that's very different, right? I mean, that there is everything, and just a little tweak of a word or a preposition, that kind of thing. And so much of the film takes place within that jail cell. And how can you get a three-hour film that's just basically these guys in a jail cell? And there's a hotel and a barn and the big bravura sequence at the end with How You Like Them Apples, where they actually use the phrase correctly, unlike in Good Will Hunting. But it's the relationship and the way that it's blocked, the way the shots are set up, to heighten this dynamic of these friends, and then Ricky Nelson, who comes in, who's kind of like the new cool friend. And I know we've discussed this once, but it has one of the best lines, I really think, in all of cinema, where Dean Martin, who had formerly been this great hand with a gun, is feeling threatened. And he says to John Wayne, do you really think that he, Ricky Nelson, is that good with the gun? And Wayne says, I think he's so good, he feels he doesn't need to prove it. It's like, boom, write that down. There is a line for all time. And there are little sequences like where Dean Martin can't roll a cigarette because he has the shakes from giving up drinking. Watch how John Wayne just feeds him these cigarettes. He hands them to him so he can keep trying, so he can do this seemingly simple thing on his own. And it's just this beautiful, small film gesture of friendship that we can instantly relate to and be like, oh yeah, I remember when Sally did that for me. I remember when Chris did that. It was really nice of him. And that's why we connect with the film.
And he also found a way to make the musical segments work. And you'd think, well, how's that going to make sense in a Western? And yet they do.
That sequence, that haunting refrain of like basically the death song. So they're trying to smoke them out of this jail cell, basically, to get them to give up the prisoner, and the prisoner's brother wants to get him back and everything, and they play, the villains, this haunting, basically, we are coming to slit your throat song,
yes.
Get you ready for that. And still, at the same time, Hawks finds the time, because let's not forget, Dean Martin, you might remember him, like Dean Martin, Celebrity Roast, right? But he was a great singer. He was a true artist as a singer. He wasn't a worse singer than Frank Sinatra. And Ricky Nelson was like a poor man's Elvis at the time,
mm-hmm.
which sounds like faint praise, but it wasn't. There's a bare family set of Ricky Nelson recordings from this period. He was a good little rocker. He really was. So there are going to be musical numbers, and Stumpy, the Walter Brennan character, gets in on it. And think about this, too. When you are in that jailhouse the entire time, and you have this kind of claustrophobia. It's like Samuel Richardson's Clarissa, where you're in the sick house and all of that. When you have the big climactic battle at the end, it's one of the great punch-the-air moments in cinema. You know how, like, when you watch the British version of The Office, and David Brent finally tells Chris Finch to bleep off? And you're like, yeah, let's do this. That's what happens at the end of Rio Bravo when they're throwing those Molotov cocktails, basically. How do you like them apples? And it's like, oh, yeah, this is the stuff. I will watch this again every time it comes on.
Two classic Westerns that are worth another viewing, or if for some reason you haven't seen them, for God's sakes, go do it. Do yourself a favor. 1939's Stagecoach and Rio Bravo from 1959. Colin, we thank you as always. Good luck with that monument in the next 7 days, and we'll talk with you again next Tuesday.
Sounds good, my friend.